Well, I want to thank Sonya for that nice introduction. Of course, thank you for coming to MSU. I'm new to MSU. This is the beginning of my second year. I came from Florida, so I survived my first year, which is always an important part of the process. I was really intrigued by the fact that we're going to have the Utopian Studies Conference here at MSU. We had actually quite a few conversations amongst the faculty about the conference and the really important questions represented by Utopia. And of course, as someone who's very interested in Afrofuturism, I'm very interested in those narratives as a really complicated concept, right? There's a really very complicated timeline associated with Afrofuturism. And when the time came to think of a keynote, I immediately thought about Ingrid, in part because Afrofuturism is so complicated as a theory, but Afrofuturism is so provocative and hopeful as a practice. And so there are very few people who are really sort of like providing us a pathway for that practice. And Ingrid LeFleur is one of those people. When you think about Afrofuturism as a practice that is going to transform, redeem, perhaps create a better future, there are very few people who have done as much to sort of realize that other than Ingrid. Because she's a Michigan native, because she's based in Detroit, this is a unique opportunity for us to think about what the future might hold. So Ingrid, of course, is a curator. She's also a pleasure activist. Ask her what that means. And a leading Afrofuturist. Her mission, as she lives it every day, is to ensure equal distribution of the future, to explore the frontiers of social justice, and to think about new technologies, new economies, and new modes of governing that are going to help us have a better future. She was, of course, the first mayoral candidate to have Afrofuturism at the core of her platform. So what she understands about Afrofuturism perhaps is a roadmap for all of us to think about the future. So it's with a great pleasure that I introduce Ingrid LeFleur as our keynote here at the Utopian Studies Conference. Ingrid.
Thank you so much, Julian. You just made my mama proud. I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to do this. How are you guys doing this afternoon? You're good? And you've been enjoying the conference? You know, when I tell people that I'm going to speak for the Society of Utopian Studies, they're like, perfect for you. Of course, right? I wear hard glasses. Where else would I be? You guys are my family, yeah? Awesome. I only have one slide today. Forgive me. I know I'm a curator. I'm supposed to be visual, but I thought one was enough. So when I was asked to give the keynote for this conference, I began to reacquaint myself with notions of utopia, happily. As a Black American woman, I've had a unique, almost desperate relationship to the idea of a utopia, that it could be established and it could serve good for all. However, in my adult years, I've come to understand that the ideas of utopia not only influence our individual direction, but also policies that affect the collective. If the utopian vision is narrowly focused, then a dystopia is created for those who stand outside of that vision. So what does utopia mean today and for our futures? I want to begin with a short journey through my relationship with utopia. As a child, I had many ideas about what a utopia may look like, as probably you may have as well. As I travel in time into my childhood, I invite all of you to also consider what your utopia was at each stage of your life. I hope it is a welcomed memory. But first, let's make sure that we're on the same page about what a utopia is. I hesitate to offer any definition in front of this illustrious society, but I will say this. I want to go to the definition my 7-year-old self thought utopia was, an imaginary place of beauty and perfectness. It was always seemed to come down to a feeling than an actual place. I guess that can explain the nowhereness of its original definition. My 7-year-old self thought The Love Boat was pure heaven. That was a TV show for those of you who were not born after the 80s. I loved it so much, I turned my parents' king-size bed into a cruise ship and would imagine the luxury of living at sea. The cruise was always filled with loved ones, and the ship staff was always happy and friendly and always felt valued. But the perfect place that fascinated me most, I still become wide-eyed when it comes up in conversation, is the mystery of Atlantis. Sorry. It was my father who introduced me to Atlantis, and it was the start of my path towards Afrofuturism. My father would tell tales about the city of gold where fruit trees were planted everywhere, and there was no need or want for anything. When he described the mythical island, I would often imagine the Atlanteans floating as they communicated with each other telepathically while picking the ripest, most delicious fruit. But my father would emphasize with a wagging finger, greed overtook the Atlanteans, and the island sunk as a result. I would have so many questions, like why, if Atlantis was so perfectly balanced and abundant, why would someone want to hoard and limit access to resources? It saddened me. It was as if humans were incapable of creating a peaceful world. My father, an avid reader of the psychic Edgar Cayce, told me one weekend that there was another island called Lemuria. He would become filled with glee when he would tell me of this ancient island that preceded Atlantis by millions of years. Lemuria, or Mu, the motherland, was said to be an island of darker-skinned people. While Atlantis was in the Atlantic Ocean, Mu resided in the Indian Ocean and connected what is now India and Africa. Lemurians possessed unforeseen powers, and they maintained a culture based on love and compassion. My child's mind burst into curious joy. A black mythical island? Wow! And Mu was the beginning of us all? I was fascinated. Fast forward to high school. I was introduced to a version of Atlantis by the short story Afro-Atlantica, written by civil rights activist and legal scholar Dr. Derek Bell. His fictional version of Atlantis was perfect for me at the time as I began formulating my own black politics beyond my parents' influence. Dr. Bell's Afro-Atlantica told of an island where only black people could survive. I was so enamored by the story that I suggested it as a model for a high school presentation to address the theme economic development in the black community. This was for the annual BASE conference at the University of Detroit's high school. Our high school group, Renaissance African Perspectives, presented the black nationals' premise that black people can only build economic wealth if we had a place where white people can come. Living at the time in a 99% black Detroit with the largest black middle class in the nation definitely influenced me. I knew what black wealth looked like and how it functioned and maintained. I was proud of our presentation. I was the Minister of Education and enjoyed imagining building an education system for an all-black island. But as you can imagine, the presentation didn't go well. People didn't like that their mothers or fathers couldn't come to our island. It was a long debate. My young mind didn't consider all the ramifications of separating humans based on race. It was a lesson I quickly learned. We cannot liberate in silos. As civil rights leader Fannie Lou Hamer aptly stated, nobody's free until everyone is free. But the question remained, how do black people build economic wealth under the weight of systemic racism? I decided to attend an HBCU, a historically black college and university. HBCUs were originally created because white institutions wouldn't allow for blacks to attend their schools. Now, HBCUs provided a place where black bodies can voice opinions without fear of being blackballed. I heard of the alienation that many of my high school friends endured at the start of their freshman year of a white college. My parents didn't think I should have to deal with the hassle of racism at the start of my career making. HBCUs were a great option because they were a nurturing environment for young Black bodies with all the intellectual rigor necessary to compete in the world. I attended Spelman College intentionally. I wanted to be among Black women and to learn the leadership skills Spelman is known for. Spelman is nestled in a cluster of Black colleges and a university. The entire area is beaming with Black students from all over the African diaspora. I cannot express to you how much fun it was. Spelman wasted no time in shattering our young realities. The summer reading before freshman year shook me to my core. There was an essay by the feminist theorist Dr. Beverly Guy Sheftall that basically told me that all of the institutions, marriage, education, religion, were to control my Black body. First, I didn't even know marriage was an institution. My entire matriculation at Spelman reoriented my world and brought so much harsh clarity. I graduated no longer naive. I could no longer claim ignorance about the global effects of white supremacy and patriarchy. I could no longer say I was not exposed to the movements of resistance and the long legacy of decolonizing within the United States and around the world. During this reprogramming, I realized that people were not only fighting to be free, but also to create the dream they've imagined. Liberation movements of all kinds had leaders with a vision that extended long beyond their life. Resistance to power structures involved the careful crafting of a new reality where those power structures are weakened, if they exist at all. As we learned about systems of oppression, we learned the ways in which people have not only opposed the limiting systems, but also developed something new. Never perfect, but hopefully more peaceful. The dehumanizing of the Black body ended at the gates of Spelman and every HBCU. It was definitely 4 years of an intellectual utopia. It was then, in my HBCU bubble, I was introduced to Afrofuturism. My brother, Brett Crenshaw, who's also a curator, was attending Clark Atlanta University and DJed Broken Beat from London. Me, a few years younger, eagerly absorbed all the tales from London's music scene in his tiny college campus room, filled with stacks of records and books. Amongst the clutter of curiosity, he told me about Afrofuturism. It was as if within my Black utopia, I found more people, a global community to play with. I dove right in and was introduced to the Yahoo listserv launched by Paul Miller and Alondra Nelson that gathered Black geeks and nerds from all corners of the multiverse to convene, converge, and converse about all things Afrofuturist. Although the term was coined by cultural critic Mark Deary, a white man, Afrofuturism centers Black bodies and gathers the lovers of Black speculative fiction and aesthetic. In the beginning, it was fun to be introduced to cosmologies and mythologies and legends that I never heard of, such as the jazz musician Sun Ra being from Saturn, and the Dogon cosmology that tells of the amphibian-like beings, the Nomo, who came from a star Sirius to impart sacred knowledge that they still use today. It was Atlanta-based artist Kevin Sipp who would indulge me and informally give short lectures about the time before patriarchy. My mind would explode. There was a time before patriarchy? Born in the wrong time now. My utopia quickly sharpened to include this matriarchal era where the Nubian temple priestesses were said to be caregivers of the community. They harvested food and did the accounting for the entire village. It was said they possessed all the knowledge of our mysterious universe. I still like to imagine what that time period looked like. My notion of utopia was formulating and expanding. It also became clear to me there was a logical way to attain this utopia I was imagining. But as I mentioned earlier, I didn't fully understand that one person's utopia is another person's dystopia. Moving to Detroit revealed this truth to me. When I returned home to Detroit in 2010, the transformation was slow in the city, but it was steady. People had access to spaces downtown we could only dream of now. The neighborhoods were reorganizing and fortifying. But there was a billionaire, a white cis man, who had his utopian vision in mind to create a place that he felt at home in and that where he could prosper. That dream does not include the current Detroit, which is 85% with its 85% black population. As comedian and commentator D.L. Hughley said, the most dangerous place for black people to live is in a white person's imagination. I see someone nodding. Over the past few years, there has been a crackdown on street artists of Detroit. They are fined and receive a felony charge when caught. Even a black muralist was arrested for painting a mural that the city commissioned him to make. He forgot his license that day. It was later explained to me that there is a whitewashing of the city that is happening. They are not only literally painting over the murals with white paint, but also trying to make the city more palatable for suburban whites. That is why the police is ignoring all the requests of building owners to leave murals unmolested. I suppose the murals are too urban, which equals black. A thorough whitewashing will take all that urbanness out. Based on the policies of spatial and structural racism and the policing of black bodies, it is clear the whitewashing of Detroit is intentional. Americana structured a utopian vision of civility and organization, a place where respectability politics reigns and communities are littered with white picket fences. The white-centered fantasy of an American utopia cannot exist where black bodies roam free, especially in the Make America Great Again era. You see, the black body is uncontrollable, which equals uncivilized. Black culture allows for natural forces and evolution that cannot be contained or controlled. But as the paintings of Norman Rockwell illustrate, there is no space for black bodies to reside in this sterile vision. Dr. Bell wrote as a preface to Afrolantica, black people are the magical faces at the bottom of society's well. Even the poorest whites, those who must live their lives only a few levels above, gain their self-esteem by looking down on others, on us. Surely, they must know that their deliverance depends on letting down their ropes. Only by working together is escape possible. Over time, many reach out, but most simply watch, mesmerized into maintaining their unspoken commitment to keeping us where we are at whatever cost to them or to us. Can you blame white bodies? For over 400 years, white men, women, and children have been programmed that America is their utopia to mold and cultivate, where white men will forever be empowered to control the destiny of this nation. However, these black and brown bodies must remain servants in this scenario, invisible and silent. Black bodies only serve most useful when producing a product or when leveraged to be sold, mortgaged, or used as collateral. And if those enslaved persons are disobedient, whites are imbued with the power to violently dispose of them. And we can argue they still have that power. The white man remains master in these lands, is what they were told. However, the Emancipation Proclamation, along with the Reconstruction Era, Civil Rights Movement, Black Nationalism, and Obama becoming president, are just a few moments of history where rebellion and course correction has disrupted the white supremacist utopian vision. when football player Colin Kaepernick took a knee in 2016 during the American anthem at the start of a game to protest police brutality, he disrupted the American leisure pastime where nation pride and city pride is celebrated collectively. He broke the Americana trance and ended the willful ignorance. The horrors of America's past and present could no longer be denied. Each knee taken over the years questioned time and time again the authority and vision of the white man as master in this domain. The constant demand by black and brown bodies for freedom to be seen and heard and to be humanized counters the colonial narrative that has been centered for so long. The United States of America is a perfect place for whites to be free and grow and prosper. So it should not be shocking that Detroit is being aggressively colonized. Because of the value of Detroit is immeasurable, there are policies to further marginalize black and brown populations of Detroit. Although Detroit is surrounded by 20% of the world's fresh water, which is the new gold, Detroiters are to contend with the reduction of resources. Weekly, the city government shuts off water in thousands of households, especially in the summer, to force people to pay their bills. The water bill is one of the highest in the nation. With Detroit facing a 64% poverty rate, how exactly does the mayor think we are to pay these water bills? The racial wealth gap is front and center in Detroit. You can see the effects of the lack of capital, which not only reduces ability to access resources, but also prevents residents from investing in their own neighborhoods and simply denies them the power a billionaire would have. For instance, our white mayor, first in 30 years, has been advocating for the police department to adopt biased facial recognition software. This facial recognition software is to identify potential criminals, but instead, it reads the faces of darker-skinned women as men 31% of the time, according to a report by Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Black women are the largest population of Detroit and head of most households. A case of mistaken identity could be devastating to a family. The tracking of black people and their potential imprisonment is intentional and in line with the colonial need to contain black bodies and keep them in servitude. But as Detroit's power structure tries to blatantly control black bodies, the Afro future rapidly approaches. I was just in Lagos, Nigeria, where I was told of a report that stated one in four Africans are Nigerian, and one in three people will be African by 2100. We're about to be Nigerian. What we have been asserting since the start of the Afrofuturism movement, and so has Alicia Wormsley with this wonderful billboard, there are black people in the future. It's statistically true. We are all about to live in the Afrofuture. To be clear, white supremacists around the world are not comfortable about the idea of the world becoming African. Even for some of you, it might be uncomfortable. I'm uncomfortable as I consider how the world is plagued with anti-blackness. Right now, we have a president that emboldens a part of the American population that completely rejects any black and brown future because that was not part of the deal. The American dream did not include reparations, closing the racial and gender wealth gap, affirmative action, reproductive rights, gay rights, everything. As the country grows and expands and leans towards inclusion, Trump supporters continue to carry out their white utopian vision regardless of what people think. How can we create new visions of a utopia that can prepare us for a peaceful Afrofuture? Our collective perception of Africa has been shifting and trending in some cases. Africa is the hotspot for contemporary art, fashion, music, and food. African culture is rapidly spreading with the help of social media and the internet. Public gatherings like the International Conscience Series, Afropunk, help us to collectively celebrate the diversity of Blackness within the African diaspora. The online magazine OK Africa highlights the latest trends coming out of Accra, Johannesburg, and Nairobi, to name a few. But it was the Disney-produced movie Black Panther that established Africa as a power place within the global public imaginary. Wakanda, the utopian African country Black Panther is the superhero Black Panther is from, helped to visually illustrate a world where Black people are not only the warriors, but also the innovators. Definitely not without critique, it must be admitted that Black Panther has reoriented our idea of utopia and introduced an Afrotopia based on Black desire, vision, and ingenuity. Through the years, we have seen attempts of creating a Wakanda, a wealth-producing Black utopia, similar to Dr. Bell's Afrolantica. In 1907, W.E.B. Du Bois documented 154 African-American-owned cooperative businesses, 14 producer cooperatives, and 3 transportation cooperatives, 103 distribution and consumer cooperatives, and 34 real estate and credit cooperatives. In 1918, Du Bois created the Negro Cooperative Guild, which provided cooperative economics education. However, in the summer of 1921, in Greenwood area of Tulsa, Oklahoma, a fire brought an end to an era of Black prosperity. At the time, the wealthiest Black community in the U.S., the business district of Greenwood, otherwise known as the Black Wall Street, was set ablaze, damaging $1.5 million in real estate, $750,000 in personal property. That amounts to $32 million today, and left about 10,000 Black people homeless. These are just a few examples of enclaves of Blackness explicitly built to improve Black life and provide a way for Black people to exist within a system that decades ago thought of the Black body as property to be traded. A report by Prosperity Now, the Institute for Policy Studies, calculated that the median wealth for Black Americans will fall to zero by 2053, if we continue on this path. And with the leading cause of death for Black men between 25 and between the age 25 and 29, is because of police-related fatalities, it's hard to imagine the Afro future becoming an Afrotopia. What is made evident is that it is impossible to collectively build economic wealth within this economic system as a Black-bodied person. I am clear that this current economic and political system was not created to serve Black bodies. As a mayoral candidate in 2017, I definitely had a utopian vision. All of my naive love for and belief in humanity poured into my political agenda. I knew that Detroiters were capable of manifesting a city that cares for every single resident as if they were family. I've witnessed the resiliency and collaborativeness of Detroiters, so I have confidence that we can build our utopian destiny despite the constant aggressive attack on Black and brown bodies. That is why I call Detroit my Afrotopia. Afrotopia is my version of a perfect place, but instead of being no place, it's every place, even within. My political agenda was my attempt to create policies centering Black bodies and their need for protection and service. This utopian vision looked like independence from utility companies and building hyperlocal systems for renewable energy sources. I wanted to completely stop poverty in Detroit while also eliminating crime through restorative justice practices. I wanted Detroit to own the water system again. I believed every resident should have access to fresh, clean food and fresh air. I want the city to grow hemp so that we could use it for cement for our roads, clothing, rehabilitating the soil, and so much more. I also wanted us to own our salt mines again. Artists would be able to thrive and focus on their practice with ease. And the governance system would be horizontal, bringing more power and granting system back to the Black clubs and neighborhood associations. And the economy would have a strong local focus. Essentially, I wanted Detroit to become autonomous, completely independent from the state and federal governments, so they no longer push their racist agendas through our city government. Sci-fi writer and godmother of Afrofuturism, Octavia Butler, tells us how to construct these small autonomous communities through the construction of the Earthsea community, which she talks about in her books, Parable of the Sower and Parable of Talents. Butler's character, Lauren Olamina, leads this intentional community and states, it's about learning to live in partnership with one another in small communities, and at the same time, working out a sustainable partnership with our environment. It's about treating education and adaptability as the absolute essentials that they are. A dear friend of mine has created a compound that I would definitely hide out in if an apocalypse comes to visit. They have rain catchers that recently caught 11,000 gallons from 1 inch of rainfall. They've also placed those rain catchers in neighborhoods throughout Detroit. There is a hydroponic fish system, solar panels, 3D printers, laser cutters, and an internet speed that is faster than lightning. And the entire neighborhood has free access to all of these things. Their neighborhood is filled with gardens and farms and parks and even a putt-putt golf course, all of which respects the local ecosystem. The artists of the neighborhood, and this is how I came to learn about the neighborhood, have created a community land trust to help guide the development in the area. This is what I would call an Afrotopia. Understanding the constant subjugation of the Black body, my friend freely constructs safe spaces with all of the accessibility. This is when survival mode turns into thriving into the future. What if we tried to create these portals of peace and collaboration within our neighborhoods instead of the nation state? What would that look like? Would it be possible? Emerging technology tells us, yes, it is possible. I have learned how emerging technology, especially blockchain technology, can support our utopian visions. If we want a world where we can be free, where resources are abundant and efficiently managed, then blockchain technology is what we seek. Blockchain technology was introduced to the world with the launch of Bitcoin. Bitcoin was created by Satoshi Nakamoto as a sharp antidote to the 1% and their greed. In the Genesis block of Bitcoin, they posted an article of the UK banks being bailed out when the recession hit in 2008. This critique was to illustrate that this technology intentionally eliminates the needs for banks to act as intermediaries and thus can no longer take advantage of the 99%. This digital ledger relies completely on machines and complicated equations to verify transactions. It allows for currencies to exist that aren't tied to the whims of government and the global economy. It also allows for the creation of an economy that is based on the values and the needs of communities. This means that as Black bodies, we can finally get to choose to not participate in a capitalist system that was built for white prosperity and the enslavement of the Black body. The digital ledger, blockchain, was supposed to course correct us so that we do not need to create the dystopia we love to depict over and over again in movies and literature and music, where resources are scarce and competition is deadly. We are programmed for an apocalypse, an unimaginable dystopia, because we know collectively we are not heeding the warnings of, say, climate change. Some of us are resigned to and even desire time of every man for themselves, because we know those in power will continue to want free and forced labor and will choose profits over children and the earth. That's the capitalist way. How can blockchain technology fortify our resource-rich communities and bring us closer to our Afrotopian vision? The goal is neighborhood self-sufficiency, collaboration, trust and transparency, and shared accountability. Blockchain technology can provide this to us via a decentralized autonomous community, otherwise known as a DAC. Decentralized autonomous communities are digital communities that develop their own currency. Members of the DAC are able to build and control an economic system based on their values and shared vision. Because blockchains are immutable and copies of them are everywhere, the decentralization and cryptography keeps it secure. So even if, like in Tulsa, a hub for the DAC is burned to the ground, copies of the DAC are digitally held elsewhere. The decentralization also means there is no one person leading the group, only the collective. The shared and often rotating leadership model allows for new versions of governance, and since many aspects of DAX are automated and transparent, then the administration could potentially be minimal, allowing for members to spend their time engaging in other interests. I are deploying a DAC in Detroit to help people access mesh nets going up in neighborhoods and to service those 40% adults, 70% youth of Detroit who do not have access to broadband internet access. By increasing internet access for Black and brown people, they will be able to increase digital literacy, protect their communities, and learn to innovate with the emerging tech that is currently crafting our lives. Essentially, Detroiters will have more control over their destiny. By actively reestablishing a new utopian vision that no longer excludes or subjugates a people for whatever reason, then we can strategically create this utopia based on shared values and vision. It is still possible. We don't have to be like Atlantis and sink because of greed, oppression, and anti-Blackness. Love is the way forward into the Afrofuture. Detroit is ready for the Afrofuture. I am certainly ready for the Afrofuture. Are you? So, if you will indulge me, would you please stand up if you can? And we are going to usher the Afro future in with a bit of movement. This is Burna Boy, he's Nigerian. Enjoy. Thank you. Dance with me. Thank you. I see you.
Da 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 me, my nigga. Where's it going? G-Wagon, all the Benz. Think I let me ride the road. I'm a beat, die for nothing. My nigga, where's it going? G-Wagon, all the Benz. Think I let me ride the road.
Don't be shy.
Make you no say anything when you do, they must commend it. So anything we had to do, I'd try to do it on my way. Plenty, 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 so far we be faced. Just to make sure money day. But my people don't go say, I don't want buy, I don't want die, I don't want baby, I want enjoy, I want jump life, I want buy motor, I want build house, I still want to know. Tell me, my nigga, where's it gone? G-Wagon, all the baby, take a lip, ride the boat, I know feet. Different things them happening, schemes and packaging. In a one night for shows, I'm juggling. Flow like the ocean, my boat, I'm paddling. Shout out Shina Bella, that's my bro, my family. Rules and dreams. When it comes to money, I did concentrate. Because I didn't stress, you are not my bitch. If you become, you shall not be here.
I love you ladies over there. You're awesome. You guys are ready for the Afro future. Guys, I appreciate that. Oh, I forgot about the question. Yes?
Well, I wanted to know, I've never been to Detroit, but I've known a few people who live there, and they talked about how great it was having Canada so close by.
Yeah.
People say, oh, I do my shopping in Canada.
Oh.
Not healthcare in Canada.
Ooh.
And so I'm wondering, I think to a lot of Americans, maybe you should think about the sort of National Health Service in Canada and you say, wow, that's a huge improvement over what we've got. To what extent does having this country right next door, very close to Detroit, that in some ways might seem utopian? To what extent has that, if at all, influenced the sort of Afrofuture?
Yeah, I mean. Okay. basically, Detroit being next to Canada, how does that influence our city?
Yeah.
Generally speaking, well, I think. You know, it's really interesting when my mom and I go to Toronto, my mom is always like, oh, this feels so amazing. Like, you can feel the change immediately. So that speaks to the fact that it doesn't exist in Detroit. It doesn't really influence us. I think that, you know, our conversations, like when talking about Handmaid's Tale, we're right next to Canada. We just take a boat over. So that is like, you know, more of our relationship. But because now that you have to have a passport. So back in the day when I was growing up, you only needed a driver's license to cross the border. And now that you have to have a passport, it makes it very cost prohibitive for so many to be able to actually get the passport and to cross those borders. And they're heavily policed. So back in the day, you would just be like, I'm going to have dinner. And they're like, cool. And now they got dogs out. This is all on the American side. The Canadians are so sweet. but yeah, the Americans are very harsh, so it makes it very, so it actually, Canada no longer kind of resides in our imaginary because it's difficult to access it for majority of Detroiters.
Has it had like sort of a lasting influence? I mean, given this,
the lasting influence. I mean, I think, you know, recently I've been doing a little bit of research about Black people escaping to Canada. And so in Detroit, like, that's how the conversation just, like, ends there. Like, you escape to Canada and everything's okay. But then you get to Canada and you find out that 80% of those who escaped to Canada came back. And that the KKK was there, and they were lynching there. And, you know, slave catchers would go into Canada and grab people. So this idea, I mean, it had its own utopian feel of, like, freedom and liberation, quickly erodes when you actually know the history. And it just becomes yet another place for Black bodies to contend with in just a different way. Oh, thank you.
I was recently in Canada, kind of going off the last question. I recently heard the Algonquin Anishinaabe woman, Lindsay Lachance, talk to the dramaturg at U Ottawa on the idea of landing, which is centering theater and performance as a practice in which First Nations people center their knowledge, skills, and culture, kind of within like honoring the creative process.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there a frontier? I don't know if I understand what that means. I apologize. I see. From the imaginary into the reality. So how do we move from imagination to reality? I think. I feel like the communities that I spoke of, like my friend that I gave an example, we're actively manifesting that which we imagine. We're not satisfied to just imagine it. But also, you have to understand, this is a state of emergency. This isn't like, you know, I get to kind of think about creating new economic systems. It would just be fun. Like, no, people are dying because they're poor. You know, people are mentally, you know, unstable because of the economic violence that we've been enduring for centuries. So I think, you know, we are constantly trying to figure out what is that connection. And that's why I work in blockchain technology, because I'm trying to make that which we theorize real. And I do believe that it's very, very possible. But yes, the transition point is tricky, right? So just thinking about DAX, I think a person, once you say you can have a digital cooperative, create your own money, and it's based on whatever you guys want and need, people are like, dope. But if I have to tell you that it's based on blockchain technology, that's when it gets a little complicated, right? And there's a learning curve, and there's a belief that you shouldn't maybe teach people that. But I believe I want a fully educated consumer base. Like, I'm tired of being passively a consumer. Like, I still don't understand how the internet works. Like, you know, we all use it 24/7. And so, but that then means that entity like Facebook can make billions off of me because of my ignorance. So always, you know, thinking about what are those steps, how much do I need to know, what are the skills I need to gain in order to get to that point, is the trickiest part of it. And have enough money and access to be able to get there is probably the biggest hurdle, actually, not brain space. I got less space up there. I don't know. I'll do man, woman, man. If you identify as a man, you can go. Okay. Yes. Yeah, it looks very dystopian. Yeah, so the question is, how can digital currencies lead us to that utopia, or in my estimation? I think that, so what's interesting about digital currency, anybody, we all could have our own token right now. So that's a thing. So I don't think that before we ever imagined creating money necessarily. I know that we have community currencies, but that's still an entity doing a thing and it's very centralized. In this scenario, everyone gets to participate and everybody gets to experiment with creating a new economy, which is kind of wild, actually. It's like the Wild West. The utopian part of that is me thinking that eventually the USD won't hold any more power. And we specifically need the USD to not hold any more power. It is currently the global currency. If you want oil as a country, you have to convert into USD in order to buy. So although it's not backed by anything, it still gives you access. So I think that by eliminating that central power, that central economic power, and then redistributing it can create an equalizing effect. This is why the newspapers and politicians will speak negatively about cryptocurrency, because it does take away their power, and it, because there's governance models attached to it, it takes away their power and it takes away a bank's power. But on the flip side, what's happening is that you have Walmart adopting blockchain technology for their food supply system so that they can identify if something was wrong with a leafy green, the exact factory it comes from. You have JP Morgan creating their own digital token for internal use. You have Facebook creating LibraCoin. So, you know, understand that when they start demonizing a thing, they, meaning media and everything, it's usually because it's challenging a power structure. And yes, at the moment we got like mining farms with Bitcoin, but there's so many cryptocurrencies that are trying to be more environmentally friendly, and they're active, intentional about that approach. So once we get that together, and I think that the clunkiness will actually go away after a while. It's kind of like the first cell phone, remember? It was like this big, probably gave you cancer within the first 5 minutes. So, but now we have like touch screens and it's small and blee, blee, blee. I mean, we're still using child labor to get Colton to get our phone, but let's skip that part. Let's just look at the fact that it's not as clunky. Lord. So everything is tainted. So it doesn't, like, it's, you know, your utopia is going to have a little, you know, spice to it. So, you know, I think that there's that, but then thinking about forced labor, these kind of supply chains help us to eliminate that. So that then you, a company can say, I got my chocolate, free trade, and I can actually show you. And I think that, and then, so then companies will start having a moral ethic, maybe, that they want to, I mean, they'll be part of the branding, and I'll just make them more money. But at least, you know, it will say, hey, you know, we're not using sweatshops to build a thing, and we can show you.
I think just in the interest of time, two more questions.
Okay. Yeah, you too. It, whatever you wanted.
My name is Reese. I had a few questions on what I heard online, which you were talking about. can talk about these type of issues, like we talk about racial issues and different things that goes on in more of a majority of a white country. How do you feel about that? Does it make you uncomfortable to talk about these issues for yourself?
Like in a white room? Nope. No, it doesn't.
Another thing is, like, what would you say to people who, like, because I've ran into, like, issues where, like, people think, like, the racial issue with the playing field is evil. Like, would you say don't exist? Like, would you mean, like, there's no disconnect? Like, everyone has the same opportunity. Well, how do you feel about that in a way that is very, like, how you talk about them, say everything very uplifting, very bubbly, but in a way, for me, like, some of those things are frustrating.
Right. The inequities, yeah. So talking about racial issues with a white audience, I think you might have to like build up to that because it does take a lot because you don't know how people will respond. But what I've come to understand that more and more people want to learn and are more open to trying to confront maybe their own racial biases and issues. So it's a good time. You're in a great time to talk about racial issues in a majority white space. I wouldn't say like in my mother's time it would be like the easiest thing to do, but now I think it's much easier. I will say that Afrofuturism helps to bring something super heavy into a non-threatening kind of space, because that's the thing. You don't want people to feel like it's a personal attack. We really want to talk about the system because it's beyond the individual person. No one in here has the power to end any of the things that I was talking about. But individually, we can work towards it, and hopefully collectively, it will come to a point and something will emerge. But Afrofuturism is my portal, and it just seems to be more welcoming and more fun. And it talks about some really heavy, heavy things. But because you're talking about science fiction or fantasy and magical realism, it kind of comes at it in a different way. And it kind of expands the conversation as well, I think. So, you know, kind of how you frame it is, but then it also depends on who you're talking to. So, yeah, it's tricky. Yes. Yeah, sure. I hope I don't repeat myself from the book, but since you're reading it. But I'm a pleasure activist, and that means that I live by the pleasure principle. That means every moment of every day should be pleasurable. And in terms of my work, I think it's really important to introduce ideas of pleasure when you're in a tech space, because they're all about function and just trying to get things done. And if we do not think about pleasure, so that means that if we don't talk about how something looks, the aesthetic, the design, the feel, the smell, the taste of a thing, then we're kind of negating the humanness of it in a way. And it's like kind of a way of keeping us disconnected from a thing. And so for me, that thing would be life, and I'd like to be fully in it. And I like when people experience joy. It feels good. And when I'm giving out the joy, I receive it. And that is really the kind of cyclical nature of pleasure, hopefully, that really should exist continuously. And I think it really would serve our society more if we were to value play and delight and pleasure and joy and laughter and dance. Well, I'm going to wrap it up. Thank you so much for having me.